Well, this morning, the title of the sermon is this: Is the Truth in Us? Is the Truth in Us? And in 1 John chapter 1, we read there, if we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. And likewise, in verse 10 of that chapter, if we say that we have not sinned, we make him a liar, and his word is not in us. His truth, his word, spiritual life, spiritual reality. And John here writing about these things to the Christians that he was addressing to show to them that it's no good just fine words or whatever, that there needs to be a reality. There needs to be something of the truth about how we live and how we go about our lives. So there's the question this morning: is the truth in us? And in order to just look at that a little further, we're going to very quickly run through the life of Jehu, the king of Israel, and just to see how, in a sense, sadly, he shows the truth of this fact that sometimes the truth, the word, spiritual life is not in us. It's not dwelling in our hearts. It's not a living experience, a spiritual reality. So, for really by way here of introduction, my first heading, the kings of the northern kingdom. The kings of the northern kingdom. This is the period of history after the division of Israel to the various parts. It's split by way of God's judgment. Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, who provoked the tribes that came from the northern part of Israel, and they, as a result, split off under Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Thus you had, and that remained to be the case right through the whole Old Testament history, a permanent division. Sometimes the northern and the southern part got on better with each other, and sometimes they were at war with each other. They were divided. And the southern kingdom, not the one we're particularly thinking about this morning, but just to get our facts right on this, this was based around Judah, but also included Benjamin, and Simeon also had been absorbed into it at some point or other. And it was centered on Jerusalem. That was its main base. That was the capital city, the city of David. It lay within the territory of Benjamin, but it is known as the city of David. So that was the southern kingdom. And by and large, their kings there displayed more godliness and righteousness than those, sadly, of the north. The northern kingdom had, as one at least of its main places, but perhaps its main capital there, Samaria, and occupied that as its central place. But within that, there had been very early on, in that northern kingdom, the various tribes there that were predominantly there, known as Ephraim, because Ephraim was the very populous tribe there, one of the sons of Joseph, of course. But they quickly displayed a desire for idolatry and an unwillingness to follow in the true ways of God. And they made idols, calves, one at Dan and the one at Bethel, and encouraged the people to worship there rather than go south over the border to Jerusalem, which was the only appointed place for worship to be conducted. That is where God had put his name. That is where his glory was. And certainly not Dan, certainly not at Bethel, and certainly not through having an idol, a calf, set up there which the people would bow down to. Well, the results in the northern kingdom was uniformly sad. There was always uproar, kings being changed, assassinations taking place, dynasties that would last a while but then be cut short as a result of God's judgment upon them for their sin, for the idolatry and along with that idolatry, the injustices that were committed within those societies, the blood that was shed, the arrogance and the desire for riches and all of these other very unhealthy and unattractive features of life in the Northern Kingdom. The kingship there would attract people for all the wrong reasons, people that wanted power, people that wanted to exert themselves there and thrust themselves forward, who would rise up and perhaps kill all the other members of the existing royal family and establishing themselves, sometimes for remarkably short periods of time before they then were deposed. People that thought that they were best placed to boss others around or to be the top people. We might know people like that in our places of work and college and elsewhere. In amongst all of this chaos, there was a king called Omri, who began to establish himself and had a relative degree of peace and economic prosperity during his reign. He had a son called Ahab, and Ahab in turn took to himself as wife a woman by the name of Jezebel, who had come from Sidon, and she brought with her the worship of the gods of Sidon, there on the coast, on the Mediterranean, and there Baal was worshipped, this god of fertility, much thought about there in the Middle Eastern world of that day. She was an assiduous follower of Baal, and she brought that worship with her and into her marriage and corrupted the worship of the Northern Kingdom even more than it had already been corrupted. Temples were built to Baal and various poles and pillars that represented some of the other deities that they worshipped. After Ahab in the Northern Kingdom, there was Ahaziah, who died of an illness, and then his brother Joram took over the crown of the Northern Kingdom. So this was the dynasty of Omri. Those are the kings, Omri himself, Ahab, Ahaziah, and then Joram. And then it ends, because it is at that point that we see Jehu, this man that was to be anointed king, to actually undermine and destroy Ahab's line, Omri's line, and then himself to become king with his sons following. So it's into that confusion of idol worship, of immorality, of a general low tone of life within society that we find Jehu emerging. So my second heading is Jehu's promising start. His promising start. Because we've noticed here that Elisha the prophet sent one of his young men to go and to anoint this man as king. Unusual in a way, most of the northern kings either seize the throne by way of assassination or doing some underhand deal like that. But Jehu was explicitly directed here to become the king and given a very clear mandate. The original instruction was given to Elijah. But Elijah was not the man to fulfill that particular instruction. It was to be Elisha who delegated this task to one of his trusted young men. And he goes and fulfills the duty given to him exactly. He finds Jehu, the commander of the army. They've been fighting against the Syrians, against Hazael, who also has been anointed by explicit direction of God to be the king of Syria. And Hazael is having the better of the battle. He has inflicted a wound there upon Joram, the king of the northern kingdom, and he's had to return back to Jezreel to recover from his wounds. And Jehu, as the commander of the army in that particular place, Ramoth-Gilead, is there resting with his other commanders when this young man arrives with this commission that he's been given to anoint Jehu as king. And we've read about that there in 2 Kings and in chapter 9, how Jehu is taken aside and told all that God intends to do through him. And he's perhaps a little taken aback by this. Some wonder, did he already know? Did he have some intimation that this was the plan for him and for his family to be? Well, perhaps he did, but perhaps on the other hand, he didn't. More likely, most commentators would say. So he then has become king, and after having been a little evasive with his colleagues as to what this young man had come to do, they didn't have a very high opinion of him, but then Jehu actually then concedes that he has now been anointed to be the king. And thus we find him embarking upon the work of judging the household of Ahab. We see his zeal and his energy in following this up. He tells his friends they're not to say anything, not to surprise or give any reason for the people in Jezreel to think there's some revolt on their hands, some rebellion. He's going to go in person and be the first to appear on the scene. And thus we find him heading off then towards Jezreel to bring about this judgment that he has been entrusted to perform by God. A good start. Word of God, seemingly, with this man. This particular remarkable way in which he has been appointed king, quite different to the usual run of things in the northern kingdom. We would say this looks very hopeful. And we find him heading off to Jezreel, this town in the northern kingdom, where Joram was recovering from his wounds. And in his journeying there, we see that he is in a very significant place. 2 Kings chapter 9 and verse 21. We're not to miss the fact that this is on the property of Naboth, the Jezreelite. How Naboth, we say, we know about him, don't we? Well, yes, we do. He had been murdered in order that Ahab should seize his land, his vineyard, a piece of land that Ahab had wanted, and his wife Jezebel constructed a conspiracy there, a plot in order to seize it, falsely accusing Naboth of having blasphemed against God, against the king, and having him then stoned, put to death. So it's there, a bit of land that did not belong to Ahab, didn't truly belong to his family, that they had seized. And having sent various people out to find out why Jehu was coming, the king then, Joram, however much his recovery had proceeded by then, but felt fit enough, obviously, to go out to Jehu and to meet with him, and then discovers that it isn't peace that Jehu has come to declare, or news from the front line there against the Syrians of victories, but it is judgment. In verse 22 of 2 Kings chapter 9, when Jehu responds to Joram, "What peace, as long as the harlotries of your mother Jezebel and her witchcraft are so many?" And Joram then turns round and says to Ahaziah, this is the Ahaziah who is the king of Judah, we'll come to him in a minute, and shouts, "Treachery." But then very graphically we learn of how Jehu drew his bow with full strength and shot Joram between his arms, and to great effect there, as the arrow came out of his heart and he sank down in his chariot. That was the end of him. There was a judgment that had been very much inflicted upon him, and then his body is thrown out onto the field of Naboth the Jezreelite. If we were thinking a moment back how people can seemingly get away with things, nobody seems to be watching, nobody catches up with them to remonstrate with them and reprimand them, well, here we can see it does happen. It may have been a fair few years later. Naboth and his family had had to endure the injustice they did, including Naboth losing his life. But God does not sleep. And the judgment was inflicted right there, in that very area, that very piece of land, as an illustration how God has not forgotten the blood of Naboth and cried out to him. Well, as I mentioned, Joram also had had a visit from his nephew, because they were related, Ahaziah. Not the Ahaziah that had been in the northern kingdom. It gets remarkably confusing here that both the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom both have kings by the name of Ahaziah and Joram. Well, the Joram of the southern kingdom, he's already died, and it's Ahaziah who is now the king in Judah, in Jerusalem. And he has come to pay a visit here to Joram. But that is a visit he is likely to regret. He is himself there the son of Athaliah. And she, in turn, is the daughter of Jezebel. So you can see how the family line of Jezebel, with all her Baal worship, not only has affected the northern kingdom, but through an unwise marriage there, Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, a good man, but unwise in whom he married his sons to, Jezebel's family has now sort of infiltrated into the southern kingdom. And so Ahaziah is the son, actually, of Jezebel's daughter, grandson of Jezebel and Ahab. And so he is there. And we do not think, because his father in the southern kingdom, Joram, was no better for this, that Ahaziah was a man who was corrupted and did evil in the sight of the Lord, as the scripture tells us. And for good measure then, while he is there, he has himself gone out to see Jehu, gone out with Joram, and then seeing what's happened to Joram, in turn tries to flee, but he too eventually dies from the wounds that are inflicted upon him on that particular day. Ahaziah, the king of Judah, also being killed and dies at Megiddo, where he had fled. So Jehu is dealing here very firmly with the idolatry of those days, dealing with the northern kingdom and its corrupt king, Joram, but also dealing with the southern kingdom and its corrupt king, Ahaziah. But it's not over with that, and we haven't time to dwell on all the detail, but if we cast our eyes then into the end of chapter 9 and into chapter 10, Jezebel, she meets her doom, thrown down from a tower, and, graphically again, there's none of the details spared us here in this inspired account, but she's eaten by the dogs. There's nothing left of her at the end of it all, and she meets a very grim and grisly end. But she's not the only one, because then Ahab has 70 sons, and Jehu puts out a challenge to their tutors and elders who are looking after them, that they've either got to put one of these up to fight him to be the king, or else, if they want to show their loyalty, to have these sons put to death, beheaded, and send their heads to him, Jehu, which is actually what they do. They comply with that particular request. The judgment continues. And then, for good measure, furthermore, the southern kingdom, Ahaziah, 42 brothers that he has, which we see about in 2 Kings chapter 10 and verse 12, they're coming to pay a visit there to Joram, to see perhaps how he is. The news hasn't reached their ears about what's happened and of Jehu taking over things in the north. They too are put to death. But judgment falls now upon them. But then furthermore, those 42 brothers having been killed along with the 70 sons there of Ahab, next it is the Baal worshippers. The Baal worshippers. And that we see in 2 Kings chapter 10, verse 18 and following. Jehu deceives them into believing that he, Jehu, is actually a very enthusiastic worshipper of Baal. In fact, he puts Ahab, he says, into the shade in terms of the zeal with which he worships Baal, and a particular feast is proclaimed, and special clothing is given to all the priests. And then when they're in the temple and the sacrifice has been made, Jehu has arranged that his men will then come in and kill all of the worshippers of Baal. Well, what zeal! With what energy this man is prosecuting this case, with what zeal he is going about the business that God has given him to do. But now my third heading, unholy zeal. Unholy zeal. Well, we learn of him from the watchman that Joram keeps consulting with as this party, this group are advancing towards Jezreel. And the watchman is able to conclude that it is Jehu. And he concludes that very famously there in 2 Kings chapter 9, verse 20, because he drives furiously. This man is a man of action, a man of great impulse, great energy, a man who we can well understand how he became to be the commander of the army there at Ramoth Gilead. driving furiously. But there's something more, and we see that in 2 Kings and in chapter 10 and in verse 16, where he greets a man coming from the south there, Jehonadab, the son of Rechab. And he brings him up into his chariot, having asked him, "Are you with me or are you against me?" And Jehonadab agrees that he is with Jehu in this particular venture. And so then he gives him his hand, helps him up into the chariot. And then he said, "Come with me and see my zeal for the Lord. See my zeal for the Lord. Watch. Look at how I am going about my business. Remark upon it. Admire it. See it." Jehu gives himself away somewhat in that. There is an indication to us, a little peep into his soul there, that what is stirring him and motivating him is less an obedience to God and more something self-centered. He is boastful. There is something in those words when he says to this actually godly man, Jehonadab, that he, Jehu, is full of zeal. Just watch, wait and see. There is something too forward in this, too self-regarding, too self-praising. It's an indication of a deeper problem. All is not well with this man. An unholy zeal. Oh, he performed it to the letter. Though we may look and query some of the methods that he used and the deceit that he used, for instance, in killing the worshippers of Baal, that the ends, as it were justifying all the means that he employed. Something wasn't quite right with him. A promising start. He was there, anointed as king. Remarkable set of providences, Elijah and Elisha, the great prophets of God, involved in his coronation. And yet for all of that, the truth, it seems, was not in him. There was something missing, something wrong. For all of that zeal, rather prided himself upon it, rather thought well of himself in the way that he was going about things, could call upon others to remark at his energy and the way in which what he did should excite their admiration. All was not well. And so now my fourth heading, a sad ending. Promising start, but now a sad ending. For we learn that for all the fact that he's destroyed there, the prophets of Baal, all their worshippers, pulled apart their temple, demolished their pillars and such things as that. But he did not deal with the calves. Those idols there at Dan and Bethel that Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, had caused to be established. He left those untouched. Left them still as the objects of veneration and to keep the loyalty of the northern people away from the south and from drifting back perhaps to Jerusalem. His pragmatism, his willingness there to drop, for instance, the first commandment, no other God, or the second commandment, making idols and images of God, put those all aside in order to just enjoy the rule and reign, the loyalty of his people. That truth was not in him. And so in 2 Kings and in chapter 10, verse 29, however, we see there, Jehu did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who had made Israel sin, that is, from the golden calves that were Bethel and Dan. And the Lord said to Jehu, "Because you have done well in doing what is right in my sight, and have done to the house of Ahab all that was in my heart, your son shall sit on the throne of Israel to the fourth generation." But Jehu took no heed to walk in the law of the Lord God of Israel with all his heart, for he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, who made Israel sin. So Jehu continued to leave Israel in this saddened state. His leadership, that was undoubtedly and clearly now established, he did not exercise it for good. He did not bring to pass there the kind of clearance of these idols that the situation really demanded. The truth was not in him. The Word was not in him. He'd heard it. He'd seen remarkable things there. He'd had these prophetic words and utterances given to him. But the truth was not in him. Great energy, seemingly great spiritual interest, great action at times, but no life. His instincts weren't right. Major sticking points, his disobedience there, in a very clear and in a very explicit area, showed that all was not well, and he dies eventually outside of the kingdom of God. So my final heading is this: looking for a good ending. Looking for a good ending. And like Jehu, we must all aim to finish well. If we've started perhaps young in the Christian faith and just beginning our pilgrimage in that way, aim to finish well. Oh, it's one thing there, isn't it, to be busy in various ways. But we've got to check that all is well with our heart, that the truth is in us, the Word is in us. All of Jehu's seeming strength and bustling about there, it wasn't in him. And eventually we all have come to see that. We need to make sure that we begin well, but also everything's in place there within our heart to finish well also. Life is a lot of choices, isn't it? We make choices. There are different things that we have to respond to, situations that require of us a decision. And those decisions will come, I'm sure, for some of us there in our younger years, quite thick and fast. Choices that we make in our family life, people that we are at home, what we choose to do there, how we come across there. Our thought life, what we choose to think about, what's going on inside our heads, kinds of ideas that circulate around. We ask the question, is God in those thoughts? Is his interests and his kingdom intruding on our general pattern of thinking and way of life? And then those choices we make, people that we have friendships with, people that we ally ourselves with in whatever sense there. Is this the worship of the golden calf? Is this bringing us bad habits, leading us into lies or covetousness, bad language, whatever else that it might be? We're looking for a good ending. We're looking to be wise in the choices we make now, that we may there serve the Lord, not serve these gods of Dan and Bethel, as Jehu sadly still had a love for them. He might have got rid of the Baals, but he still had those calves there in explicit disobedience against God. How sad. The root of the matter was not in him. Is it in us? Have we repented of our sin? Have we seen these kinds of behaviors and things and thought, that is not for us, that we turn away from that? And what we find in our own hearts, do we grieve over it and sorrow over it? And we put our faith in Jesus Christ. And we've seen there is the one who answers for all of our wrongdoing, all our iniquities, all of our trespasses. We placed our trust in him, given him our full allegiance. And we anointed him, as it were, in our hearts as our king, and pledged ourselves to follow him all the days of our life. Let's look for a good ending. There was Jehu. Was the truth in him? At the last, the answer comes back, no, no, it wasn't. But that asks the question of us. So, is the truth in us? Is it in us today? And if it's not, are we going to do something about that?